Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of It's Crime Time. This case is one that I can't say surprised me that it happened, just due to how some people treat their parents and ultimately kill them over money. But what did surprise me was the sheer brutality of it. It's something that I'll never be able to wrap my head around, nor forget how someone could do something like this to their own parents. This is the case of the Guy family murders. All right, everyone, it's crime time. Lisa and Joel Guy Sr. had been married for 31 years, and they enjoyed life in their two-story home in Knoxville, Tennessee. Joel was an engineer, primarily in the piping industry, and he was a very hard worker that provided for his family. Lisa Guy was a records keeper and a secretary for an engineering firm, also in Knoxville, Tennessee. Joel had three daughters from a previous marriage, and in 1988, Joel and Lisa had a son together, Joel Michael Guy Jr. The family was relatively well off, and they enjoyed spending time together and being outdoors, and they were just a very close-knit family. The only thing was, Joel Guy Jr. was said to be relatively standoffish. He spent a lot of time in his room. He was shy. He wasn't really, into being social and talking to people, but he did spend time with his family from what I heard and from what I've kind of read about this case. But there's not much known about the type of person he was, other than he was pretty reclusive at one point. Joel and Lisa Guy had been actually looking forward to their retirement that was coming up, and it was in 2016. At this time, Joel Sr. was 61 years old and Lisa was 55 years old. They were first looking forward to spending the holidays with their children and grandchildren at their home in Knoxville. Joel Guy Jr. was going to be returning home to see his parents as well. Joel had moved out and was living 600 miles away at this time in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, so his parents were pretty excited to see him. Joel had been struggling the majority of his life with regard to getting on his feet. However, he'd attended the Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts in Natchitoches, in 2006. He had previously attended Hahnville High School. Joel had never worked and was consistently supported by his parents. He had spent one semester at George Washington University, and then he was attending Louisiana State University while living in Baton Rouge in 2016. It's said that he had attended college for around 8 to 9 years in his life, but had no degrees to show for it. In 2016, he was apparently training to become a plastic surgeon. So Joel had been kind of living away from the family in Baton Rouge for the past decade, but he was still being supported financially by his parents. He was going to college, but he was not working at this time. On November 24th, 2016, Lisa and Joel Guy Sr. had a large Thanksgiving dinner in their family home. This was to be the last holiday dinner in this home, as they had sold it and they were retiring to Sirwinsville, Tennessee, which was about 90 miles away, to live in Joel Sr.'s late mother's mountain home. Joel Guy Jr. and his three half-sisters attended the Thanksgiving meal. The odd thing about this year had been that Joel Guy Jr., who I said was usually a very kind of reclusive, standoffish type of person, seemed exceptionally happy. He was really outgoing, and he seemed super excited about something during this dinner, and it was really weird to them. But they were just happy that he was kind of getting along and doing well. And he even interacted with his nieces and nephews at this Thanksgiving party. He gave them some of his old toys, I guess, from his room in the family home and things of that nature. So he just seemed really cheery, which wasn't like him. But like I said, everyone seemed to be happy that he was just, joining in the celebration. The meal went off relatively well without a hitch, even though Joel Jr. had been highly disappointed about them selling their family home. They also made it known that they were going to need to cut Joel Jr. off financially, as he was now 28 years old and he had never had a job, and have been completely reliant on them for the entirety of his life. And like I'd mentioned earlier, he was living in Baton Rouge for the past decade, but he had no job. His parents supplied the money for everything he did. So, you know, his bills for his apartment, his food, gas, just every expense he had, his parents supplied him with the money. And they were going to need to cut him off. They were retiring. And obviously with the retirement came, you know, a bit less money in terms of they would be quitting their jobs and living on the retirement. So they were going to need to cut him off. Joel Sr. had tried to cut him off before, but he hadn't obviously taken this very well. And his mother, Lisa, had actually taken a job just so she could continue to give Joel Jr. money. He had always been very close with his mother, and she was very protective of him. And she just kind of didn't want to see her only son and actually her only child fail in life, because the other daughters were obviously daughters from Joel Guy Sr.'s previous marriage. So Joe Jr. was her only child. And she just babied him, essentially. She didn't want to see him fail. So she actually took up working just to give him basically her paychecks. So she worked and the money went straight to him, is kind of what I found in the research. The guys had mentioned to their daughters after they had left the Thanksgiving dinner that they had planned to cut Joel Jr. off financially after the get-together. And I'm kind of unsure if they had brought it up to Joel Jr. at this point, but I do know that they definitely brought it up to the daughters. They told the girls after this dinner that they were going to cut their brother off. Lisa had become very good at her job, and her coworkers really loved her. So they were kind of disappointed and sad when they found out she was retiring. But they had planned her a special retirement lunch after, you know, the family's Thanksgiving meal on her first day back at work. Lisa was never one to miss work, and she especially would have never missed her retirement dinner at work. So when she didn't show up to work on November 25th, which is the Friday after Thanksgiving, her coworkers became highly worried about this and her supervisor, because this is just not something that happened. They tried to contact her via phone, but she was not answering. This is when her supervisor actually contacted the Knoxville Police Department to see if they could just do a welfare check on Lisa, because this was not like her. And she would have at least called in if she was going to miss work. So there was a 911 call that is recorded about this, or pertaining to this incident. And I will play that on here. It is very difficult to hear. There's a lot of like papers rustling and things of that nature by the 911 operator.
Yes, I have an employee that has not reported for work today, and highly unlike her. I've tried calling her home number, I've tried calling cell phone, and can't get a hold of her. What can we do about that? Can somebody go by and check on them?
Yeah, do you know her address?
I do. It is 11434 Golden View Lane.
Okay. And what is your name, ma'am?
My name is Jennifer Whited, W-H-I-T-E-D.
And what company are you with?
Jacobs Engineering. It is 865-216-6625.
Okay, what's the employee's name?
Lisa Guy. G-U-Y. Her husband's name is Joel. J-O-E-L.
Should he be there too? Does he live with her?
Yes, he does. And they do have a dog named Jake. I think he's a big baby.
Okay. How old is she now?
She is in her, I think, late
50s. Do you know if she has any medical issues?
No. I mean, she has high blood pressure, but that's all that I know of. Moving, and she is leaving our company, but that's supposed to be Friday, and this show up.
Police obviously agreed to do a welfare check, and once they arrived to the guy home, they noticed that the doorknob had actually been removed from the back door and placed on the front door. Very weird, and I would assume that that makes them unable to get in, of course, that way. So they kind of had to come up with another way to get in, and they were kind of struck with this overwhelming heat coming from inside the home. And a strong smell of chemicals. And I guess you could kind of feel the heat coming off the house and like smell the chemicals near the door, like before they even went in. So one of the officers had to open one of the guy's vehicles in the driveway, and they pressed the garage door opener, which then of course opened the garage door and gave them access to the home. Groceries had been strewn about the floor, kind of near the front doorway, as if somebody was about to put them away, but they suddenly dropped them where they stood. And they were just kind of still strewn about there. And I would assume, obviously, that they had went bad by this point. Several large jugs of bleach were also located with some rolls of trash bags and other cleaning supplies. And they were just set on the kitchen floor, on the table. They're kind of everywhere. The officers also noted that there was this large stew pot on the stove, and the burner was turned on, and the pot was kind of like simmering on the stove still. They didn't look in the pot or anything. They just kind of turned it off. They turned off the burner and they continued searching the home without looking in the pot. At this point, initially just walking in, I'm sure that seeing the chemicals and the groceries and everything of that nature had kind of alerted them that something was kind of off there, obviously. But I would assume that maybe they thought, okay, maybe there's people in here. Somebody's cooking something. We're not going to like get into their food or get into their supplies or anything until we kind of take another walk through the home and see if anybody is in the home. So they just kind of turned the burner off, walked past, and they continued their walk through the home. They stumbled upon an even more grisly and troubling sight at this point, because right as they went up the staircase, there was blood stains on the staircase, the carpets, the walls. There was this blood everywhere. And then the thermostat showed that the heat in the home had been turned all the way up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And they could hear the family dog barking from somewhere upstairs in the home as well. Police found some bloody knives upstairs and the guy's clothing and piles on the floor, along with large containers of sewer line cleaner, baking soda, liquid fire drain cleaner, hydrogen peroxide, muriatic acid, bleach, a bleach sprayer, among other chemicals. And the home was so hazardous that police actually had to put on hazmat suits to kind of continue the search and to process the crime scene inside. The family dog had been located, and it was locked inside the laundry room where it had been locked for days. Police notified animal control, who then came in to seize the dog while the police continued their search. And from what I have researched and read, the dog was okay. The dog ended up being okay. It was probably overheated. It was probably panicking, you know, from being locked in there, and it was probably dehydrated, but the dog was okay. They did get the dog out of there before they continued any of their search. And then they went into the exercise room upstairs, which had a large area of blood splatter. Police located Joel Guy Sr.'s severed hands near this blood splatter. And then in the master bathroom, they found two large plastic bins. And inside these bins, they had dismembered remains of the guys submerged in acid. So it was Joel Guy Sr. and Lisa Guy. And this was Joel Jr.'s parents. So their remains were kind of put in these, I call them totes, like the big plastic moving totes. And he had 40-gallon ones, and he would have obviously cut them up to fit them in there, and that is what he did. And police kind of called this a diabolical stew of human remains. The police were recovering the guy's remains from the home, and as they were doing this, they noted that Lisa's head was absolutely nowhere to be found in the tubs of acid. They looked all over the place, and of course, they found Joel Sr. His head, as far as I know, was still attached and everything. His arms and legs weren't, but they found Lisa's body and her limbs. And then they noticed, well, where is her head? So they kind of went downstairs and made another, you know, examination of the downstairs area. And they located her head boiling on the stove in the stew pot. So that stew pot that they located earlier that was kind of simmering, they turned the burner off. Well, they went back later to check, and it was actually Lisa's head simmering on the stove. So that's creepy. And I don't know why, but this seems like this happens in a lot of dismemberment cases. Very creepy. Freaks me out. I couldn't imagine being the person that opened that stew pot and just discovered, you know, someone's head in there. That's terrifying. Autopsies later determined that the guys had been stabbed dozens of times. An officer at the scene noted of the crime that it was, quote, the most horrific thing I've ever encountered in law enforcement in life, end quote. So he said this was the most horrific thing he's ever encountered in law enforcement, and then kind of reiterated, well, actually, you know, in my life, because, I mean, this doesn't happen that often, and what are the odds of, you know, one police officer seeing tons of cases like this in his career? So it was, of course, the worst thing he ever encountered, he stated. Quote, it's in the 1 percentile of homicides in the United States that involve mutilation or dismemberment. It's not something we run across. Usually there's a motivation behind it. In this case, we just don't know what that is, end quote. And that was a quote by Major Michael McLean, and he stated this of the crime at first when they first stumbled upon it. This is what he had stated of the crime at first, because they were still investigating and they didn't really know a motive. Obviously, they didn't know who had done it at this point, and they were just saying they don't know what the motivation is at this point. But obviously, people don't typically do this for no reason. Now, I can't say that that's, you know, that it's never happened, because obviously there's a list of serial killers who in the past have done things like this without any real motivation or without knowing the victim. They just kind of do it because that's what they do. You know, they're driven to kill for some reason. But in this case, there was motivation. They just didn't know yet. Since there had been no shortage of physical evidence, the FBI and the East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Office placed Joe Jr. under surveillance after the crime scene was discovered. His motivation for committing these heinous crimes against his parents soon became very apparent. Money. Joe Jr. was arrested a day after the bodies were discovered, and he was held on 2 counts of first-degree murder, felony murder, and abuse of a corpse. So he got 2 counts of first degree, 2 counts of felony murder, and then 2 counts of abuse of a corpse for, you know, each one of his parents. He was arrested outside his East Baton Rouge Parish apartment on Tuesday as he walked to his car in the complex parking lot. When police interviewed Joel Jr., he told them he had been visiting his parents over the holiday. He did not disclose a motive at this time, but he did say he talked to his parents about money. So one can assume that they must have brought it up to him. They must have said, hey, you know, we're going to have to cut you off because of this retirement. And of course, he got angry and things of that nature. But you'll find out later that apparently he'd been planning this for a long time. At least that's what it looks like. So I'm not sure when he actually decided, like, hey, I'm going to kill them. But it's very, very meticulously planned out. Joel Jr. pleaded not guilty, and the case finally went to trial in October of 2020, so 4 years after it occurred. Attorney Leslie Nacio spoke at Joel Jr.'s trial. She released new graphic details of the murders. State prosecutors warned that due to the graphic nature of the crime, the scene was unlike many others in the United States. They had warned the victims' families and attendees to leave the courtroom if they felt that they would be overwhelmed emotionally. Nacios then began to explain how Joel Guy Sr. was murdered. He suffered 42 sharp force injuries so brutal that 12 marks were left on his ribs that ranged from just scratches to actually severing of the bones. Severe damage had been caused to his lungs, kidneys, and liver. He also had an injury on his shoulder so severe that a fragment of the weapon was deposited into his muscle tissue. Joel Sr.'s hands were then severed at the wrists, his arms were severed at the shoulders, and his legs were removed at the hips. His foot was severed at the ankle, and it only said 1 foot, which is kind of odd to me, because, of course, Joel removed everything else, and then only 1 foot at the ankle, but not the other foot. Very awkward, but that's what I was able to find, was it was just one of his feet. Joel Sr. had fiercely fought for his life, and after the murder, his clothing was cut off his body and just thrown in a bloody pile on the floor. Lisa was stabbed 31 times, causing 21 severe injuries. Stab wounds to the buttocks and 9 of her ribs were also severed. Her clothing was also cut from her body and left on the floor. Her arms were also severed at the shoulder and her legs were cut below the knees. And then, of course, her head was put in the stew pot. Their bodies were then placed in 2 55-gallon containers with a mixture of drain cleaner, bleach, hydrogen peroxide, sewer line cleaner, and other chemicals to try to quickly dissolve their bodies in a homemade acidic solution. Authorities say they had been killed sometime between Friday and midday Saturday. Police had also located a shocking notebook belonging to Joel Jr. in his parents' home in Knoxville. He wrote a list of things to do prior to the murders and noted items to bring with him to the murders. He also listed where and how he planned to kill his parents and discard of their bodies. And then he had notes kind of detailing his parents' assets. So I'm going to begin here with the assets. Her assets, her life insurance, $500,000, possibly more with double indemnity, with him missing or dead. I get the whole thing. All her other assets are joint, go to him if missing, unknown if he is dead. His assets includes all joint property if missing. When he gets all joint property, also gets joint debt. Knoxville house, homeowner's insurance, possibly but probably worthless after fire, owe $100,000. Sir Gwensville house, appraised at $400,000 plus, worthless with Renee on property. Her car, his SUV, his boat, his old truck. So that was a note page kind of talking about what he would get possibly if his parents were both found dead or they were missing. And then he had another notebook page. And it said, get killing knives, quiet, multiple. Get carving knives to make small pieces. Get sledgehammer, crush bones. Bring blender and food grinder, grind meat. Get bleach, denature proteins. Get plastic bin for denaturation process. Does not matter where they're killed, just get rid of bloody spots to prevent evidence of the time of death, not the mattress or couches. Get rid of bodies inside house, there and my DNA already there. Flush chunks down toilet, not garbage disposal. Douse killing rooms, kitchen, with bleach. Place her curler with flammable paper and flammable containers of gasoline in 4 locations. His killing room, her bathroom. Wipe down areas near killing rooms and bathrooms. Turn heaters up to 90 to melt fingerprints and dry everything. Set her phone to send me a text message late Sunday to prove that I was in VR and she was alive. Leave through front door and wipe down doorknobs. Timer for flammable set for Friday at 10 a.m. Sunlight masks fire but not smoke. Kill him with knife. Clean up mess from him before she gets home. Kill her with knife. Take dog with you. Place her in shower, turn on hot water, and point at her to get rid of forensics. Remove her clothes and take them with me for disposal. Place him in plastic bin and use it to get him into the upstairs bathroom. Cut off his arm and plant flesh under her fingernails. Place her hand with his DNA so that his DNA is not washed away by shower. Use sodium hydroxide to destroy his soft tissue and soften bones for transport. Based once every hour to accelerate. Flush sodium hydroxide down the toilet. Wash out bin with handheld showerhead and then direct handheld into toilet to flush anything out of the pipes and into public waterway. So that is very meticulously planned out. I mean, he literally made entire pages of every little tiny thing he needed to do to try to get away with this. What really happened on November 26th of 2016 was put together during the court hearing. So around 11 a.m., Lisa Guy leaves the family home to go grocery shopping at Walmart. Joel Guy heads to the exercise room where his son attacks him with a knife. The two struggled for control, tearing window blinds and flipping over the Bowflex workout machine. Joel Jr. eventually gained control and stabbed Joel Sr. Meanwhile, Lisa Guy is seen on camera checking out with her groceries around noon at Walmart. She comes home, she drops the groceries off in the foyer and heads upstairs. Joel Jr. meets her at the top of the staircase and attacks her with a knife. He then viciously dismembered the bodies of his parents, leaving his father's hands in the hallway and severing his mother's head. He places her head in a large metal pot and sets it on the stove to simmer. Both victims also had their arms and legs removed to fit the corpses in the chemical solution. He even inflicted wounds after death so that the chemicals could seep into the body's central cavity and speed up the decomposition process. And then, of course, after the murders, he left to Baton Rouge to have his own hand wounds treated, and he was finally arrested 2 days after the murders. And little did he know that he was actually being surveyed, like he was being watched by police for the entirety of that time. And then eventually, I guess they had gathered enough evidence where, you know, they finally stopped surveying him and arrested him at his apartment. And the wild thing is, if you look into this case, there is footage. So if you're kind of wondering if this was like premeditated for a while, we at least know that it was premeditated at the beginning of November. It was probably premeditated from the time that he knew he was going to be going over there for Thanksgiving, because he was actually caught on several surveillance cameras buying the supplies that he would later use to murder and try to dissolve his parents. He made sure to try to use cash for all of the transactions and self-checkout for most of them. He bought supplies for the murder as early as November 7th. He purchased several items at an Ace Hardware store in Napoleonville, including some muriatic acid and food-grade hydrogen peroxide. On November 18th, he went to Home Depot, and cameras actually recorded him buying the bleach sprayer, some extension cords, and the timer. And then on November 19th, he went to Academy Sports, and he is seen buying a knife there. On November 21st, cameras captured him at a Knoxville Walmart buying plastic blue totes large enough for the dismembered bodies to dissolve in. And then it's kind of odd to me, but I believe that the same Walmart that Joel bought the containers or the totes at is the same Walmart that Lisa Guy was seen on surveillance footage buying items at Walmart. So at approximately 12:15 p.m., so around noon. And it's just weird because if the Thanksgiving dinner was the 24th, Joel must have already obviously been up there staying for 3 days prior to the Thanksgiving meal and everything. So I guess obviously he waited until his sisters and all the kids and everything were gone out of the house. And then he had planned on kind of hanging out of the house there for a short period of time after to commit the murders. And then, of course, he went back home. So anyway, when Joel finally returned to Baton Rouge, he obviously sustained his cuts to his hand and he needed them checked out. He had a really deep cut, apparently, on his left thumb. And at 3:30 p.m., he was seen in Walmart's first aid section. He was buying bandages, ointment for the wounds. He got some isopropyl alcohol, hydrogen peroxide. And then I guess this was the Walmart again, I'm assuming, before he went back to Baton Rouge. And then when he went to Baton Rouge, he was getting his wounds treated at the student clinic at his college. So very odd timeline, I guess, here. It's kind of hard to decipher sometimes, but I guess he went to Walmart, tried to get some Band-Aids to bandage up his hands, and then he went back to Baton Rouge, and then he went to the clinic. And then that's, of course, when, you know, the next day after the Thanksgiving meal, that's when Lisa's boss, Jennifer Whited, kind of became suspicious of the absence, called for the welfare check, and then, of course, that's when police discovered everything. So, and you can actually look that up. To me, it's pretty gruesome. It's definitely not the worst that you would see or that I've seen, but they have body cam footage released of the entirety of the police walkthrough of the home. So when the police walk through the home and discover the whole scene and everything, it's on their body cam footage. The creepy part about it is, of course, the head boiling on the stove. Now, you don't see anything gruesome there, but just knowing, because you can hear the bubbling of the water and everything in the pot, just knowing what's in there, you know, terrifying. And for a good reason, obviously, the bodies and everything of that nature, the gore and everything is, it's blurred out, but you still know, you know, what's there if you know this case. So watch at your own risk, obviously, but the body cam footage is out there and the court hearing videos are out there. And, you know, some of that footage is included with that. So it's definitely a terrifying case to look up. But on that note, he pled guilty, but he filed a motion that he received the death penalty if he was convicted. So at first it said he pled not guilty. And then I guess he later changed his plea to guilty, but he wanted the death penalty if he was convicted. His defense team really had no evidence to present at this point against, you know, I should say against the prosecution. They had no evidence to try to prove his innocence. It was so obvious that he did it that they really didn't have a fight. In October of 2020, Joel Michael Guy Jr. was found guilty of all six counts, and he was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. He and his attorney tried to file an appeal later that was around 36 pages, stating that the police had entered the guy's home illegally due to not having a warrant, and they were just kind of walked in and, you know, checked everything out. But, and then that's when they found the scene. But this appeal was deemed to be kind of a long shot appeal. And he, of course, was denied, and he remains in prison, serving out his life sentences for the gruesome and brutal murders of his parents. And the 36 pages of his appeal are ridiculous. I found a few pages of it to read, but it was a welfare check. They knocked on the door, they tried to get in, and they sensed that something was off. They, in my personal opinion, kind of had probable cause to enter the home, and they entered, and when they entered, since it was a welfare check, they entered and nobody answered them. Nobody replied. I'm unsure of Tennessee's exact laws on this, but obviously they didn't make contact with anyone, and that their vehicles were in the driveway, and everything, you know, was, everything pointed to someone being at the home, and no one was in there. So, and when you walk right in and you see all these chemicals and blood on the staircase, you're going to keep walking around. That's kind of their job. You know, they knew something was off. So his appeal was obviously, like I said, it was rejected, and that was ridiculous. But if you get the chance to look into this case, you can look more into it. And I promise you that you're going to get very angry at this. This guy's disgusting. And sadly, I know a lot of people say horrible things like, oh, his parents, you know, they caused it because they were babying him and things of that nature. And they were giving him money and they were cutting him off. But this happens every day. You know, people baby their children every day. People give their children money. You know, when you commit, that's a commitment for the rest of your life. It's not, I have my child for 18 years and then they're never going to talk to me again. They're never going to need help and I'm not going to have anything to do with them. You know, they were good people. They were trying to help their child. And I mean, he was almost 30. Like they were just letting him know, you know, it's time that we cut you off. It's, you know, we're going to retire and relax. So for people to say things like that, oh, it's their fault. People cut their children off on a daily basis and they don't all get brutally murdered and dismembered. You know, this guy has beyond problems. This is not a normal reaction. A normal reaction, you know, to that would be getting upset, getting mad at your parents, blah, 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 whatever, sulking about it for a while and then kind of moving on. This reaction of brutally murdering them and dismembering them is not a normal reaction. And I will never agree and never believe that they caused it. They don't deserve it and they didn't cause it. But enough of my opinion. So, all right, everyone, that concludes this episode of It's Crime Time. If you would like, please consider subscribing and providing a rating or review on whatever platform you get your podcasts. Thanks again, and until next time.